Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Two babies are interacting with adults. Nathan, a one-year-old, is sitting on the floor playing idly with his toes when Sue walks in. The moment Nathan sees her, his face lights up, to which Sue responds with a broad smile. Nathan giggles and waves his arms slightly as if beckoning Sue to join him. She sits down on the floor and, laughing, asks, "What are you doing with your toes?" When she tickles his toes, Nathan pulls his feet away sharply, laughing as he does so, his big smile extending from the corners of his mouth all the way up to his eyes. Her eyes sparkling, Sue asks in a gentle voice, "Can I please see your toes? I promise not to tickle them." With a wary look on his face, Nathan slowly extends his right foot, and just as Sue starts to lean forward, he pulls his foot away and breaks out into a full-bellied laugh. Sasha, a one-year-old, is lying on the floor hugging Eeyore, his favorite stuffed animal, when Ginny walks in. When she sees him hugging Eeyore, she smiles warmly and says in a high voice, "Isn't that nice? You're hugging Eeyore." Sasha quickly looks up and struggles to his feet while clutching Eeyore. As soon as he is standing, he holds Eeyore up to Ginny with a look of utter seriousness on his face. Ginny bends over and gently takes Eeyore from his hands, saying as she does so, "Are you giving me Eeyore? Isn't that wonderful? Hello, Eeyore. Would you like a big hug?" As she is saying this, she is giving Eeyore a warm hug, burying her face in his belly. Sasha watches intently, and while she's cuddling Eeyore, he reaches up with his right hand and points. Smiling broadly, Ginny responds by handing him Eeyore. Sasha takes Eeyore and hugs him in exactly the same way that Ginny has just done, burying his head in the toy's belly. While he does this, he makes a sort of babbling sound that has the same rhythmic contours as the words Ginny has just spoken. The cuddle lasts for a few seconds, and then Sasha looks up at Ginny, and his eyes shining, he holds Eeyore up to her again. Ginny, her eyes shining with the same intensity, responds, "Oh boy, can I hug Eeyore again?" As she starts to take Eeyore from him, Sasha gives a huge smile and breaks into a happy laugh and starts to wave his hands, almost as if he were trying to clap. These interactions in the progression of thinking and language development are so basic that you might be surprised to learn that only one of the babies described in these passages is human. The other is a chimpanzee. Which do you think is which? From a parent's perspective, what should we know about language development in children? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest and his co-researcher author have moved beyond the familiar nature-nurture debate to offer a radically new theory of human development. Dr. Stanley I. Greenspan is clinical professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at George Washington University Medical School and chairman of the Interdisciplinary Council on Developmental and Learning Disorders, the world's foremost authority on clinical work with infants and young children. He is founding president of 0-3, the National Center for Infants, Toddlers, and Families. Dr. Greenspan, whose work guides the care of infants and children with developmental and emotional problems throughout the world, is the author of 37 influential books translated into over a dozen languages. His latest, written with Dr. Stuart G. Shanker, is The First Idea: How Symbols, Language, and Intelligence Evolved from Our Primate Ancestors to Modern Humans. Dr. Greenspan is the father of three grown children and has visited with Parents' Perspective several times before. Welcome back, Dr. Greenspan.
Nice to be with you.
What do you consider the most important concept parents should remember about a child's language development?
Well, the most important concept is that language begins at birth, and language progresses through many stages before a child ever utters his or her first word. And so, for example, when we have an eight-month-old baby who's smiling and vocalizing and maybe doing a little bit of pointing and showing or taking and giving, and you have your familiar peekaboo games or the variations on peekaboo games, what you're really having there is an exchange of emotional or affect signals. And if you see the facial expression of a little baby, you'll see there's almost an infinite variety of textures of emotional expressivity already on the horizon. And parents, if you watch caregivers respond back, there's almost an infinite texture there too. So there's a very subtle pre-verbal language occurring through emotional signaling. And what we've discovered and written about in The First Idea is that it's this pre-verbal emotional gesturing, which we've identified in terms of six critical or foundational stages, as we call it, that leads to language as we commonly think of it in terms of the exchange of thoughts and ideas through words.
You want to go through the six stages?
Each of these stages we think of as emotional transformations. And I use that term, and I apologize for using a technical term, but before I describe the six stages, let me just explain that emotions are not static or specific entities like we've always thought about them, like fear or happiness or anger or rage, as though they're a fixed entity. And then you have your cognition or your thoughtfulness, and you say, should I express my anger, or shouldn't I express my anger, or should I show I'm happy, or shouldn't I show I'm happy? That's the old view, that you have intelligence on the one hand and emotions on the other hand, and they're kind of fighting or cooperating together. Rather, we see the emotions as going through a series of transformations at each of these six stages I'm about to describe. And each time these emotions get transformed at one of these stages, they become part of a new organization, a new level. And this new level, this new organization, makes us both more intelligent, brings us to a higher level of language development, and brings us to a higher level of social and emotional capacity at the same time. So all these specific skills that we tend to think of as separate, like the ability to read or to do math or to talk, are actually part of this larger whole, which we describe in terms of these emotional organizations, which are the result of these, quote, transformations that I'm talking about. So let me describe the six stages that will bring it home. When a baby is first born, the baby is learning to be calm and regulated and take an interest in the world of sights and sounds and smell and touch. So commonly we see a 1 or 2 month old baby looking towards mommy's face and voice. Mommy goes off to the side and says, oh, sweetheart, oh, aren't you my cute little angel? Oh, you're so adorable. And what do we see little Susie or little Johnny doing? They turn gradually and they find mommy's face, and then you see a big smile beginning to emerge, and by 2 months you see a little smirk, and by 4 months you see really a glorious smile emerging. Now, what's happening in that simple little interaction at this first level of organization? Well, what's happening is the baby is not just doing a simple sensory motor action, i.e. hearing the voice and turning towards it. The baby is doing something far more profound. The baby is connecting their affect or their emotion, their pleasure in hearing that voice, to the sound of the voice, and to the motor action, the act of turning, that helps them find the voice. So we don't just have a sensory motor pattern, we have a sensory affect motor pattern or a sensory emotion motor pattern. So the emotion or the affect connects what we perceive, what comes in through the senses, with what we do, how we act. Then by 4 months, by the second stage, we see the baby go from just an interest in the world to a glorious, pleasurable, joyful interest in the world, where there's all kinds of textures of pleasure and delight, as well as rage and anger with our four-month-olds. So now we see a broadening of this organization with more emotions in it. And the pleasure becomes the organizer for the baby's sights and sounds and movements. Then by 8 months, we achieve our third level, and all of these are gradual, obviously, where the baby now is exchanging many different emotional gestures. Smiles of delight, looks of curiosity, angry growls, bemused little glances. So there's an almost infinite texture of emotions being expressed, and mommy or daddy is typically responding with these same emotional expressions back or different ones, and we get a dance of back and forth. Now we're getting purposeful interaction. The baby is learning cause and effect. I smile, I get a smile back. I frown, I get a frown back. I go, rrr, rrr, make an angry sound, and I get a surprise look back. So the baby is now learning cause and effect thinking through emotional signaling. What we have discovered is the baby leads and learns about the world through his emotions, not through his motor actions. The baby has more control over their emotional expressivity at an earlier age and uses that to explore the world. So by our third stage, we're now getting the emotions orchestrating early forms of logical thinking.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on language development in children.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Stanley Greenspan about language development in children. Now, what happens in a situation where a baby is in child care, and there are lots of babies in child care, and the caregivers can't do this kind of emotional dance back and forth with the same frequency?
Yeah, or richness, or texture, mm-hmm. or amount of time. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we've observed caregivers in busy child care centers, busy daycare centers, where we have one caregiver for four babies at the best centers. And it just doesn't happen as much as it should. And what we observe is that babies are being ignored when they should be being played with. So it's one thing to let a baby sleep when they're tired, which is great. It's another thing when a baby is sitting up alert and awake and ready to be played with, and we miss that golden opportunity. Now, at home with an individual caregiver, that baby, presumably when they're alert and awake and mommy is changing little Johnny or Susie, or just before feeding or just after feeding little Johnny or Susie, they have these playful interactions. Most moms or dads don't even think about all the wonderful thing they're doing. They're just having fun with little Johnny or Susie, making little funny faces. But in a busy daycare center, even the best caregivers, who are truly gifted workers, they're overwhelmed. They've got to go to the crying baby. You know, with four babies, imagine a single mom with, you know, quadruplets. I mean, that's quite a chore. So what we've observed in the daycare centers is the babies aren't getting as much of these interactions as we would like for them to get. And in fact, our studies are now showing, when we do systematic studies of children who are in full-time daycare, 30-plus hours a week, is that they're showing the challenges that result from this. For example, babies in full-time care show increased cortisol levels by the end of the day compared to kids reared at home.
And what is cortisol?
And cortisol is a stress hormone. So that's what goes up when you're stressed. And typically, in the second half of the day, the cortisol levels go down. It's a diurnal rhythm. You know, it kind of goes up a little bit and then kind of tails down by the end of the day. And children reared at home, little babies and toddlers and preschools reared at home, that's what happens. But in busy daycare settings, because there's, you know, so many other little infants and toddlers around, and it's a noisy environment, there's a lot going on, and there's not enough caregivers, because by the time a child is a toddler, there are often six toddlers per caregiver. By the time it's a preschooler, there may be six or eight preschoolers per caregiver. That's a challenging environment for the kids. And their cortisol levels are going up. 90% or more of the daycare centers for infants and toddlers are not considered to be of high quality. Kids thrive best, infants, in one-on-one home settings, you know, with devoted, sensitive caregivers.
Now, we covered three stages. Can we cover three more stages?
Yeah. So the third stage, as I mentioned, where the baby is learning to signal with their emotions, and they're learning the beginning of logic, the beginning of cause and effect. Then the fourth stage we call shared social problem solving, where the baby is now stringing together many gestures and doing things like taking mommy by the hand, walking her to the toy area, pointing to the toy they want, motioning to be picked up, and the mommy picks up the child, they get the toy and give mommy a big smile. And that is a monumental leap, because now the baby is solving problems through a pre-verbal emotional gestural language involving 50, 60 back and forth mm-hmm. communications in a row. And that's ushering in a sense of self. It's ushering in the ability to recognize patterns and think in patterns. It's giving the baby the ability to understand concepts before they have the words to describe the concepts. So the baby, for example, is understanding what love is, because love is being taken care of by mommy. It's being told you can't touch the wire by mommy. It's being made to feel safe and secure by mommy. It's having fun with mommy. So love becomes a combination of many of these experiences. So the child has a sense of what love is about through
millions of these interactive emotional experiences. Then when the word love is learned, let's say 18 months or 20 months or 22 months, the baby already knows what it means. It becomes a shorthand label for these millions of experiences having to do with love. This makes it possible for the child to use emotional signaling to negotiate things like anger and excitement. So the baby isn't at the mercy of their catastrophic emotions, where they go right into fixed action, where they get impulsive. So they're able to do what we call separate perception, what you see, from the action pattern associated with it. So a 3-month-old baby, you know, sees mommy and is hungry and starts crying. A 16-month-old baby sees mommy and is hungry and maybe goes, points to their mouth or takes mommy by the hand to go to the refrigerator. And now you get shared problem solving and gesturing, replacing these fixed actions.
And that presupposes that the previous interactions have been satisfactory.
Have been very rich and not only satisfactory, but rich and glorious. And so when you substitute signaling for fixed actions, you separate the perception, the image, from its fixed action pattern. That allows you to have freestanding images or freestanding pictures in your mind, so to speak.
And that's the first idea?
Yeah. And these are multisensory pictures. These are pictures of sight, of sound, of smell, of texture. And these multisensory images constitute the first idea. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then we invest these images with all kinds of meanings through further emotional experiences. So it's the ability to signal with your emotions that enables you to separate perceptions, what you see and hear, from what you do, to have freestanding images and invest these images with meanings. This is the birth of human symbols. Now, this occurs in this fourth stage in the life of every baby and child who's developing in a healthy way, and occurred during the course of human evolution with our pre-human and human ancestors as they mastered these stages of emotional signaling. So we have evidence from the fossil record and from studying chimpanzees and other non-human primates. We've been able, in our book, The First Idea, to show the sequence at which this happened during the course of evolution, where species progressed from simple levels of emotional signaling to more advanced levels, and finally where we got early humans, where symbols came in because of the ability for emotional signaling, and that led to language. And it led to our fifth stage, which is creating ideas and symbols and investing them with meaning. And we see that in pretend play with kids, and we see it in the meaningful use of language. I'm hungry, give me a hug, I love you. And then the sixth stage, which is the last one I'll talk about, is where we combine these emotionally meaningful ideas together to think logically with symbols. So the baby says, Mommy, go outside. And we say, why? Because I want to play. And then if that goes well, it progresses to what we call the more advanced levels of thinking, where you learn to give you many reasons for why you want something. And you do what we call gray area thinking. A child can tell you how much he wants to go outside, or how happy he is, or how sad he is. And finally, where you can think along two lines at once. You have a sense of self, which is evaluating what you do on an everyday sense. So you can say things like, gee, I'm angrier than I should be today. Or I agree with Mark Twain, but I disagree with Tolstoy when you're writing an essay. And it's that ability for reflective thinking, which means you have to have a sense of self that's reflecting on your day-to-day experiences, which is our ninth level. So it goes up from the basic six to more advanced levels, and then continues throughout life. But each of these involves a critical emotional transformation that, as I mentioned before, leads to growth cognitively, leads to growth socially, leads to academic growth. So everything we do is off of these core emotional transformations.
So it sounds like the core emotional transformations have to be pretty good. In other words, the caregivers have to be pretty well tuned in to get the results you want.
Right. The better the caregiving, the better these, quote, transformative experiences are, the better the kids do. And when we look at children from orphanages, for example, who haven't had these experiences, we shouldn't be surprised that they have language problems and motor problems and social problems because they haven't had these, even if they are born with very healthy brains. And we studied multi-problem families where we knew the kids were healthy at birth because we'd studied them at birth, and we saw even by 2 months of age they weren't having these emotional experiences they needed, and therefore weren't forming these higher-level organizations. If we can find ways to, in an innovative contexts create these emotional interactions. We can help children regroup and master stages they may have missed. And then they can still learn to be creative and reflective thinkers.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on language development in children.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $10 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Stanley Greenspan about language development in children. Dr. Greenspan, how significant would you say cultural practices are in a child's language acquisition?
Well, cultural practices are the way in which one generation learns from the prior generation how to create these rearing, transformative experiences, how to do the emotional signaling. And we find what's very interesting in terms of culture is that there are things that are different from culture to culture. So every culture is a little different, but there are also things that are relatively similar. So almost all cultures we've been able to study, you never say all because there's always one more that you haven't known about, but almost all that we've been able to observe have ways of engaging the infants and of ways of exchanging emotional signals, caregivers to infants, and of ways of doing the shared social problem solving. And so these six stages I mentioned, there's different ways in different cultures, but they all have some common features, or again, most of them that we've studied, in helping babies negotiate these six stages. Now, what differs, though, is where the emphasis is and how negotiation occurs. So, for example, take the fourth stage of shared social problem solving. In one culture, there may be a much greater emphasis on limit setting and obedience. So the gesturing and the problem solving is much more structured and organized in a kind of do-as-I-say mode. In another culture, it may be much more following the baby's lead, much more expressive, much more creative, much more let's-see-what-you-want-to-do kind of approach. Very different emphases, very different processes, but they both involve a lot of emotional signaling. But in one, it's more focused on setting a limit, the no-no, and in another, it's the yes-yes, show me more.
And they both move towards the next stage.
And they both move to the next stage of using ideas. Then when you get into the using ideas and pretend play, one culture may emphasize pleasure and, you know, play with doctors or taking care of the dollars. Another culture may emphasize more wars and aggression and competition and conflict. So the dramas vary from culture to culture, while the stage or the structure has certain commonalities, at least in many cultures.
This is a conversation that we could go on with for a very long time, but unfortunately we have to close. And before we do, we have to know the answer to the important question, which is, which of the two babies was the human baby and which was the chimpanzee?
Well, which do you think? What do you think?
We read the book, so we know.
Well, you know. Well, it turned out that that Sasha,
was
a little baby, you know, little human baby. But what's interesting is that in terms of these early stages, there's more commonality and similarity between our primate ancestors and humans. And where we begin seeing the differences is in the latter part of the fourth stage, when you get into shared social problem solving and you get into very complex circles. We learned a lot of these interactive behaviors from our primate ancestors. It wasn't just genes we got from our primate ancestors, but we've got these interactive practices, particularly through the middle stages of stage four. And what's further interesting is that everyone always thinks that our ability for intelligence and language and thinking are encoded in our genes. They're not encoded in our genes. They depend on these experiences. If the experiences are missing, language doesn't develop, like in children who grew up in orphanages.
Yeah.
Grammar doesn't develop. Grammar and language are dependent on these interactive experiences, and they're taught from one generation to the next through these practices that have been passed down over millions of years, where each generation teaches them to the next, dating back to pre-human primate, non-human primate cultures. So that's a change in our theory. And obviously, there'll be those who would choose to debate that point. But we think we have fairly substantial evidence for this point of view, that the genetic part of the brain is in its ability to recognize patterns. So we're wired to recognize patterns. We're wired to learn. But the brain depends on experiences to develop. And so the brain itself is an outgrowth of these transformative experiences, just like our social skills and our intelligence.
In addition to your book, Dr. Greenspan, The First Ideas, How Symbols, Language, and Intelligence Evolved from Our Primate Ancestors to Modern Humans, which is a mouthful,
right.
What other resources would you suggest to our listeners who want to explore some of these ideas further?
Well, there's a prior book called The Growth of the Mind, which also explores this territory and will be a nice complement to The First Idea. And for those readers or listeners who are interested in very practical applications of this theory, for children with special needs, we have a book called The Child with Special Needs that is available in most bookstores. And also for children who just have challenges but not special needs conditions, we have a book called The Challenging Child. And for kids who are developing without challenges, typically, we have a book called Building Healthy Minds that helps parents use this theory and this model for rearing simply healthy children with curiosity and intelligence and lots of social skills.
Do we know the authors of these books?
You certainly do.
Same guy,
yeah, right?
Well, we have to thank Dr. Stanley Greenspan for a fascinating interview, and all of us as parents and adults who care about children have learned an awful lot today. So thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I look forward to the next time.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Dr. Greenspan's latest book, The First Idea, How Symbols, Language, and Intelligence Evolved from Our Primate Ancestors to Modern Humans. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please spell anything that's not obvious. That helps us a lot. That's 1-800-791-8573. Mention show number 257. Tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was funded in part with generous support from Irene Polan, founding president of Sister to Sister, Everyone Has a Heart Foundation, a program to educate women about heart disease. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.